Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform. Welcome to the show, guys. Today we're joined by Mike Hamra, who is VP of Engineering at Bluecore. Thanks so much, Mike, for coming on the show on this, in England, quite a grey Friday afternoon. I don't know what it's like where you are.
I am in Brooklyn, New York, yeah. And we are in the tumultuous times of spring, where it could be 60 degrees one day. Today it is also gray and overcast, windy and chilly. Okay. So hopefully, by the time the weekend rolls around, we will have better weather.
Yeah, fingers crossed for that. Now, I think it would be great if you could give us a bit of insight into your background and how you came to working in technology.
Yeah, fantastic. So I have always been around computers. My father owned a Apple computer store in the 80s and 90s when I grew up. But I didn't start programming until I went to college. And I just seemed to have this natural affinity, you know, to computers, to programming. I reluctantly use the term engineering because I do know some serious engineers. And that's always a fun debate of software development through engineering. But at the end of the day, I really liked technology. I liked building. I liked creating. I unfortunately happened to graduate when the tech bubble in the early 2000s crashed. And all of my computer science friends had ended up going into finance.
Wow.
I ended up finding a job as a consultant writing document review software for law firms through a mutual friend at a Shakespeare festival that I had a summer job at. So it was a kind of interesting bit of luck. And that kind of took me on my journey of working in technology and seeing the various ebbs and flows and working for a variety of great companies. Most of my career was spent early on at a company called Getty Images, which is a photo and video agency. And I really loved the product. I loved the systems that we were working on, really trying to move the world's most beautiful imagery. It was like the constant pulse of the world, distributing images and video kind of content. I had spent a few years working at Uber, and that was pretty exciting for the scale and size and the growth of systems that we were working at being part of that time. And I worked at a HR software as a service company called Namely, which was, I think, really helping small companies grow and navigate. And I had the benefit of being exposed to a lot of great management principles, you know, at that company. Working for an HR company, you pick up on great HR HR principles and HR lessons, which was really fantastic from a learning perspective. And that brought me to Bluecore, which is an e-commerce marketing company. I like to describe it as a data science as a service company, helping e-commerce retailers really understand recommendation and personalization, which is a very important component of today's world, moving mostly online and trying to get better engagement with customers. Where we can't be physically together.
Pretty much your whole career been working with like some serious like cutting edge tech. And just before we get into the main conversation, I just want to find out where you go to for influences and like what resources you rely upon to kind of continue learning about this and staying ahead of the curve.
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel I've been very lucky in the sense that the environments that I've worked in were very conducive to learning, to experimentation, and to healthy risk-taking. A lot of the work was, and this goes into some interesting motivational principles with management that I've picked up on, is this notion of mastery, autonomy, and purpose. And this comes from a book that I actually haven't read yet, but when I saw a presentation called Drive. I apologize, I forget the author. But where you have an environment where you can hone your skills, where you can learn and be exposed to new technology and be experimented and develop that mastery, where you have autonomy, not going off and doing your own thing and working in a box, but have the ability to determine how you want to work, how you want to plan, how you want to iterate, have that flexibility of figuring out what you need to do and how you want to do it. And most importantly, the sense of purpose, which is what are you being asked to do? What are your goals that you will apply the autonomy and you will apply your mastery to do? And a lot of the companies that I've worked for have had really good purpose or tried to hone their purpose so that engineers and the teams that support those engineers have the ability to get work done. Mm-hmm. And I've worked with great people, great senior engineers that I've learned from. I've been in environments where we talk in technology about learning from failure, being able to fail, and learning from those mistakes, having great dialogues with colleagues, both who are more senior than you, but also who are just coming into the industry, who are asking those really good questions that, you know, may seem obvious answers, but are really, to a certain extent, challenging the status quo, right? Why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? Well, because. And you may not realize that you are developing that ivory tower architecture, yep, or you're over engineering. And it goes back to this notion of how do we iterate? How do we take those incremental steps towards that goal, towards that purpose? And when do we have to change direction? And I think over a course of time, you know, you've seen enough wins, but you've also seen enough failures. One of the great questions that I like to ask management interviewers is, tell me a time when you've had to cut a project, or tell me a time where you made a mistake, where you've asked your team to do something and it turned out your original assumptions or your original hypothesis were incorrect and you did have to make a tough call rather than trying to push a big boulder up a hill and up a rock.
Yeah.
Up the mountain.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about technology is, you know, you have to think outside the box to progress in tech. I mean, not necessarily just in terms of to progress in your career, but just to create technology that's, you know, like I keep saying, ahead of the curve. It's like, you know, if you look at Elon Musk now, he's thinking outside the box and he's, you know, he's allowed to and he's got no constraints. So I think it's really important, you know, when you're thinking about technology and when you're employing people who for your team and, you know, when you guide people and mentor people, it's important to kind of give them that message that there's no constraints, because if people felt like they were tethered or tied down, then, you know, nothing new would ever happen, you know?
Yes, and I think that that's a great point, because the other failure mode there that I've seen, which is interesting, is where you try to chase every new shiny object, right? Where you try to think of, oh, this new technology is going to come out. We have to use X, we have to use Y. I've been guilty of this myself. But the thing that I really like about this notion of mastery and purpose is you can put your work into context. And I think that that's one of the interesting, you know, learning lessons of leadership. I call this the toolbox that you're developing and how you use that toolbox to kind of determine your own destiny or determine how the cookie crumbles. Yeah. As a concrete example of this, you know, you learn a new language and you feel adept at a new language. You may learn a new database technology. And you feel really good about your database technology, right? Those become your fundamentals. You may know how to optimize indices on a table. You may know how to write multi-threaded code in your programming language. You're really good there. Now, those skills are easily transferable, right? Mm-hmm. Programming languages fundamentally, at the end of the day, are not that different, right? You have functions, you have clean code, you have good system boundaries. You know, plenty of languages have different ways of doing multi-threading, but you develop these opinions of how you want to work and what you like doing and how you can be productive. And you apply that to this notion of purpose, right? What are you really trying to do? Mm-hmm. And when you're evaluating new technology, and technology in and of itself has no solutions, right? It's how you use that technology, absolutely, how you plan for it, how you maintain and how you evolve it. And you use these skills that you develop in your career and these patterns to apply that technology effectively. One of the interesting cases that one of the mistakes or I think challenges that I had done is I was very attracted to this notion of service meshes, which are very popular now. We think of Envoy and Istio and Linkerd. This is one of the, I think, cutting edge technologies that you're talking about in the world of Kubernetes. I had fostered the adoption of Istio at a company I was working at far too early. And my purpose was we needed a way to gain leverage across the entire organization. We needed better observability. But I think that what was interesting is I forced a solution into that purpose and it became bigger than I had anticipated, right? I didn't effectively iterate and say, you know, what I really need is observability and what's the easiest way that I could introduce that into the organization. We ended up changing our CI/CD pipeline. We ended up trying to do way too much with load balancing and routing all at the same time. We didn't effectively iterate. Now, we got through it. And it was probably more of a brute force attack than I would have liked to. But, you know, I remember that when I think about how do we adopt new technology, why do we do it, and what's the most effective way to introduce that technology into an organization?
Well, exactly. That is the perfect way to kind of, perfect example to kind of describe that and prescribe that. Prescribe. What am I going on about? Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I'm just thinking about your kind of leadership style now. I mean, how do you kind of empower your team to think in that kind of way and think in that kind of progressive outside the box kind of way?
Yeah, that's great. A good friend of mine has this joke that I absolutely love, and I've said it way too many times, which is weeks of coding can save you hours of planning.
Yeah.
And I take that with me in the sense of how do we talk about software development lifecycle, and I think that we get a little bit maybe consumed in ritual or cargo culting to a certain extent, but it goes back to this notion of purpose and asking why. And in terms of thinking about leadership and technology and engineers, it honestly goes back to this principle of what tools are in your toolbox. And when we think about what we have to accomplish, you know, we discuss what tools do we have, right? What gaps do we have in our technology that we feel we need to introduce, or what problems do we have that we're spending too much time on? And when do we have to refactor? When do we have to do that? And if we can plan a little bit and you can have those brainstorming discussions, and it doesn't even have to be within your organization. One of the things that I love about open source technology is everybody's using these technologies. And so you may be in a 10, 20 person company, but there are Google groups, there are forums, there are meetups, there are GitHub issues that you can have these discussions on where people are facing the same problems as you are. And you can determine whether or not this tool is adequate. How do you use the tool? What are the operational costs or other things that you have to be aware of to use this tool? And you can have those discussions as you think about what is the most pragmatic way to move forward and how are people solving the problems that you're solving, right? But I think a lot of people don't necessarily know what problems that they're solving, which goes into this notion of misdirection and purpose. And you end up saying, you know, how do I get here? I love this concept of, I cited a lot, called yak shaving, right? You want to solve a simple problem, and then that leads to another problem, that leads to another problem. And the next thing you know, you're shaving a yak in Australia. And I think it's because we've lost sight of purpose in our work, and we just have to keep ourselves in check. And, you know, that's a healthy functioning team, you know, in those daily scrums is thinking about what are our goals? Are we taking steps towards those goals? Are we maybe misaligned? Do we have to readjust and have that really great iteration cycle, which is what Agile is really about?
Yeah. And, you know, and I've spoken to a lot of people on this podcast who, you know, work in technology, and, you know, a lot of people say when they're looking at resources or, you know, if they're looking to learn about new things, they say, you know, they go on like YouTube tutorials, or, you know, they do a lot of reading, or, you know, like going on blogs and websites and listening to podcasts. But at the end of the day, I really think that, you know, there is that tech community out there, and it's worldwide. And the best thing you can do, I think, in my opinion, is to learn from people. I mean, people that are solving similar issues to yourself, and actually just reaching out to that tech community, because it's definitely there to be used, you know.
It is. And I think everybody learns in their own way. And, you know, the tech community could be a junior engineer creating a YouTube video of their introduction to Python, or it could be a person with a 30-year career talking about the internals of socket programming on the Linux kernel. And you could watch the YouTube video, you could do a coding exercise in order to be a part of it, to just expose yourself and practice. This goes into this notion that learning notion that another friend had talked about, which is the word Kaizen, or that Japanese notion of practicing, right? You have to practice like anything to get better. And it does take time to hone those skill sets, but you make a little bit of progress each day on your career journey.
You know, I'm thinking about, you know, code camps and things like that, you know, for people to get into the industry quickly. But do you think there's a certain kind of mindset that people are thinking, you know, who aren't really interested that much in technology, but want to kind of change their career and just go, well, I'll do a 6-month code camp or a course, and then I'll be in a new job with doing coding, you know? Do you think that kind of mentality is out there, where it's like, I'll give it a go and, you know, 6 months down the line, I've changed my career?
Yeah, absolutely. I've worked with people who have switched their careers, and I commend those who are really disrupting their lives. I mean, it takes a lot of risk and a tremendous amount of self-confidence to say, you know, I've been a lawyer for 10 years, I've been doing X for 15 years, and I'm just going to dramatically change the course of my life. And it's great that we have an opportunity to create those avenues for people to switch their careers if that's what they want to do, and have that level of flexibility and freedom in order to do it. I do think that one of the things the technology community can do much better at is creating more jobs and more access to junior engineers. This is something that, you know, I personally struggle with in trying to figure out, where you either have to go into a really small company that is just starting off, that just needs people, and you have to figure it out by yourself. I think that's kind of how I got lucky when I first entered the workforce. Or you have to go into one of these very large companies that has an internship program that translates into an entry-level job position where you work for 1 to 2 years, and you're almost gated or boxed into what you need to do. I think that opportunities, and I think that this is a sign of very healthy companies and healthy processes, where you have the right level of senior engineers, mid-level engineers, junior engineers, a really good management structure, and a really good purpose, mm-hmm. that you can introduce junior engineers pretty healthily into your company. One of the positive things that I've seen a lot is this concept of sales engineers. And, you know, sales engineers, I like the process because it gets you exposed to technology, it gets you exposed to understanding what you're doing. There's an opportunity to leverage the product that you are working on, and you get to meet people, and you get to have a dialogue and brainstorm and problem solve with people, which is a tremendous skill set to have in technology and in programming. And I think, you know, I'd like to see more flexibility between this concept of sales engineering and traditional R&D development, because I think it's a great avenue for engineers who are entering the industry to kind of come in and participate and, you know, get in the editor, think about architecture, think about different systems, and learn from different companies who have different systems and ask questions. And like you mentioned earlier, build a network. You know, you may be talking with somebody at another company, you know, what's your architecture? How did you solve this problem? And you're building a network of peers that will last you your entire career.
Yeah, that's great advice. There's a couple of things that I've taken from that. I mean, what is great nowadays in, you know, is that code camps are really taken seriously in the industry. It's not just, you know, I think gone are the days where you'd need to study this at university, really, and do like a 4-year course or however long it might be. You know, I think people are really taking code camps seriously, and especially with junior levels. And that's just amazing that people can just switch their career like that. I mean, in the past, you know, a few years ago, because my brother is an iOS developer, so he was constantly trying to, you know, get me to do code courses and things like that. And my thoughts were at the time that you kind of have to love it to be successful in it. And I still kind of think that way now, because everyone that I speak to on the podcast or any, you know, engineers that I know all seem to kind of like live and breathe the technology. It's not just a job. It's almost like a way of life. I don't know where I was going with that, but yeah, it's really, I just kind of went off on a bit of a life philosophy.
Yeah, no, I love to get into some life philosophy there, yeah. Especially, you know, with the events of the world in the past year. I think, to your point though, I don't actually think that, and I think that this is a mistake or a trend that we're in the technology industry changing, is that your job doesn't have to be a way of life, right? Obviously you want to love what you do, yeah. And you want to be passionate about what you do. That notion of fit, of need, interest, what you're spending your time on is super important. I do think that people burn themselves out by focusing way too much on work and they lose sight of the bigger picture. And I have two children, and as difficult as working from home has been this past year, it's great that I get to have dinner with my kids every day. And I truly appreciate that.
I mean, do you think, or do you feel that there's a tendency for people to look at their careers in, you know, I don't want to say the wrong way, but do you feel there's a tendency for people to look at their careers in kind of a hindering way, in the kind of way that's not, you know, going to help them progress?
I think that people do feel like they could be stuck in certain places.
Absolutely. Yeah.
My personal experience that I had, and I think one of the interesting things about my career is that I've actually been in and out of management throughout my career. I found myself, you know, working at a small startup, loved coding. I was an IC. It was fast and loose. It was a really good environment for what I wanted to be doing. It was tough. Some people weren't able to work like that. And I think that goes into the role fit of a company. It worked for me. The company ended up getting bought out. And I found myself as the one that was appointed the manager, right? You were the most senior person. You have a reasonably good communication skills. We need somebody to fill the spot. Why don't you do it? And I found myself very early on with a director title, no previous management experience, running a team of 8 people. And my boss, who I don't think that I fully appreciated at the time, I jokingly said that he had one mandate. He was actually in another office, and he said, you know, you can do whatever you want, just don't mess up enough that I have to get involved into your day to day, right? Which is a very weird way of saying, I'm giving you autonomy.
Yep.
You have your purpose. And I didn't connect the dots at the time, but over the course of 5 years, it was definitely getting thrust into management. And being a manager, I think I skew too much on the technology side. I talk about management being about people, process, and technology. I hated process. I was all right with people. I was really good at the technology portion. And over the course of 5 years, I realized, you know what? I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah.
I don't want to be a manager. I don't even know what company I want to work for. I quit. And my wife and I, was one of the best experiences of my life. My wife and I ended up traveling around Asia.
Wow.
For 7 months.
Wow.
And that was a very liberating experience for me in the middle of my career, because it was really the first time since I graduated college, or university, as you like to say on the other side of the pond, that I felt like I had such freedom, that I felt like, okay, I could go into any industry that I wanted to do. I didn't have to be this type of engineer. I didn't even have to be an engineer anymore, right? But what did I really want to spend my time doing, and what did I love doing? Because I wanted to change that. And I didn't realize that I was like in this path that I didn't really decide for myself. And it wasn't until I made this sudden move that I kind of took a breather and figured stuff out that I really decided, you know what, I want to go back into being an IC, and I want to focus on technology, and I want to focus on building things again, and not the people and process that I was really struggling with.
Yeah, and it's really interesting, because you've seen both sides of the coin, haven't you? So, and one interesting aspect of engineers is, I think by nature they are, you know, enthusiasts. They love what they do, and when you get to that certain level, like what happened with you when you get thrown into a management position, you kind of have to take your hands off the, you know, the building and the engineering aspect and manage a team of people, which is totally different. So I find that a lot of people have that experience, but when you get to a certain level of engineering, what can people do instead of, you know, if they want to progress more, but would you say that there was a ceiling there that they reached and then the only next step up would be to be a manager like you did?
Yeah, it's actually a great question. And it's an interesting failure mode when we think about purpose and the authority that comes along with leadership and how to gain authority, whether it's influential authority or direct authority. One of the interesting things for me is when I went back to being an IC, I found that I was much more effective as helping people grow as a principal level engineer than I was as a manager. I think that there was less pressure for your direct reports to give themselves, allow themselves to be vulnerable. But I also realized that if I was a better manager, I would have created an environment where my direct reports could feel vulnerable with me. And that's since a lesson that I've taken away now. But I also felt like as a principal engineer, stepping back, that the authority that I really wanted was on that long-term technical direction. And I was in an environment where principal engineers, because they were given a certain amount of autonomy and they were very explicit with their purpose, could figure out and have that dialogue with one another of how do I move forward? How do I make systemic changes with our technology? How do I influence product in the work that I do? And what I took with that is people get into management very early because they want to understand how decisions are made. And they feel like, hey, if I'm a manager, my manager is making all of the decisions. If I'm a manager, I can either make those decisions. And that's a very, I think, fixed mindset and a very limited aspect of organizations. It's also just not true. I mean, even if you are a leader, as much as you want to be making all of the decisions and have everybody, you know, do exactly what you say, you know, there are mechanics that are involved. It's just, you can't be a totalitarian, you know, dictator leader. It never works. So you really have to understand this notion of influence, of developing purpose, of thinking about strategy. And you can do that as a manager. You can do that as an IC. To your point earlier, it's what are you really passionate about? And how do you want your career to evolve? How do you want your skill set to evolve? It doesn't have to be linear. Right? You can choose to be a manager for a certain amount of years. And I've seen people do this, I mean, myself included, and then say, you know what, I've done the people and process and created these environments. What I really want to do is I want to play around with this technology. And I want to just put on my headphones. I want to focus in my IDE. And I want to understand this technology, or really producing code, because that's where I want to spend a lot of my time. Like a majority of my time is thinking about that technical direction and doing that. And I don't necessarily want to help people along with their careers as my primary responsibility. You certainly want to do that indirectly as a good teammate, but you don't want to be held accountable for that responsibility. And so what I think I challenge engineers who want to get into management is saying, what problem do you want to solve, right? Why do you really want to do this? Do you want to do this because you feel like there's a constraint and you don't have influence? Because we can talk about ways of giving you influence without the responsibilities of management, which is really about people, process, and technology, and being responsible for how well your team is executing, and I think how well your team is planning for the future, so that you get this nice feedback cycle of direction and execution, and creating an environment for your team and all of your individuals to succeed in that space.
Do you think the most important aspect of a manager would be to, I don't want to put words in your mouth here, but to kind of like, this is a very loaded question.
Okay, I love loaded questions. Set me up. I love loaded questions.
Okay. Do you think the most important aspect of a manager is to empower their team and help them kind of grow in their career?
I think that is an important aspect of being a manager. I don't think it's the only one, because I have seen teams fail in which they've had a very great manager that has been a true advocate for their team that has completely misaligned themselves with the overall company and caused a tremendous amount of friction with other teams because they have been, and I think one of the interesting challenges that I have now at my, you know, my VP level, which has a much broader range of influence over a specific team, is how do you balance team-based velocity with organizational based velocity?
Yeah.
Right. So you can have a high functioning team that's doing really well, but they may be doing it at the expense of the systemic, you know, architecture or processes or involvement of an entire company because of effectively misaligned purpose. And that's a very difficult thing to weigh. To answer your question in a different way, I would say that one of the great books that I highly recommend is by Julie Zhao, and it's called The Making of a Manager. And it was about her experience as going from an IC to a manager at Facebook. And I think that it's a great, I wish that I had read it in like 2005 or 2006 when I was undergoing this journey myself. But she is the one that I cite from this notion of people, process, and technology. And this notion of, I think, how well your team is executing, and but not just how well you're executing, your team is executing, because you could be a slave driver, your team could be executing very well, but everybody's miserable. But how well you're also planning and creating success for the future, right? How well are they gelling? How well are they planning ahead, responding to different changes, and thinking about setting up their own destiny, right? If you are constantly making short-term decisions that you know you're going to have to pay for later, you're incurring a lot of tech debt, right? You are actually controlling your own destiny by making your system brittle and hard to maintain and not investing in it. And, you know, you as a manager may need to push back on whoever is forcing that and plan better. Or you may be doing it yourselves and not even realizing it, but you have to balance the execution and the planning so that you have a very healthy process.
Yeah, I mean, I have huge admiration and respect for managers. In fact, actually, respect and admiration for good managers, because it's such a difficult balancing act that you have, not only trying to kind of, you know, do well for the business with your team, but also empowering your team. And also even beyond that, there's even, you know, even minor frictions in the office between certain people. I mean, you know, a lot of this, when the management is good, goes unnoticed. I mean, like you said right at the start of the conversation, it's far easier to spot bad management than it is to spot good management. And when management goes unnoticed, they're probably doing a great job.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that experienced and skilled leaders see that and know that. One of the things I'm very grateful of is that the industry in general has, I think, appreciated the importance and notion of good line managers.
Yeah.
And I was at a company that shunned management. One of the cultural values was let builders build, which was effectively weaponized for anybody can do whatever they want. My boss had something like 30 direct reports at one time. And, you know, it's, I think it's very typical of a fast growing company. You know, let's just get a lot of, hire a lot of engineers. Let's make sure that they're, you know, brilliant entrepreneurs. We'll let them do whatever they want. And the core degrades, right? I think that we lose sight of people and process that makes and ends up inevitably making the technology very unwieldy and frustrating to work with. And so this notion that we have now of, and I think that we've learned and adopted from, you know, information that's existed, like this is not an unsolved problem, that healthy teams, healthy functioning teams are led by people who can, I think, be empathetic, have empathy, have strategy, have a certain skill set of their own, but also help others with their skill set, right? That they may have one set of tools in their toolbox, but they understand, oh, this other person has these set of tools. And if I kind of connect the dots, you know, I can build a much better house because, you know, this person has a hammer and this other person has a nail gun.
Yeah. And I've actually seen, like most of us have, bad management and good management. And the difference is unbelievable. I mean, I really appreciate good management now, and I really respect it, and I can see it a lot more clearly.
You know, this notion of bad management, I think was really interesting too, because I also think that it's important to realize that nobody wants to be a bad manager.
Yeah.
I've never met anybody who was like, you know, intentionally malicious. And I think that in retrospect, I think if I had to manage myself when I was 20 years old, you know, like, you know, I felt like I knew everything. I was gung ho. You know, one of the feedbacks I got is like, you know, Mike, you go into like an architecture meeting and like, you know, you throw down the gauntlet and then you expect everybody to push back. Like, I think that I was like, if I had, I have total empathy for my managers when I was a young IC, and I felt like they were bad managers, but they weren't. They were actually really great managers that I don't think that I understood what they were coming from. And so I think that, and what I hope that if you're listening to this and you feel you have a bad manager, is you are in an environment where you do have open and honest one-on-one communication where, you know, you maybe not saying, hey, I think you're a bad manager, but, you know, here's where I think you can help me, or here's where I think that we can improve the situation. Or, you know, tell me why, I'd like to understand why you made this decision, because where we can gain more signal, like for one, and what I tell engineers who are maybe frustrated with their management is you, as part of your own career progression, you're going to want to have these conversations. And, you know, there's no better time to experiment with having the conversations than being in an environment where you need to have them, because, you know, what's, you know, one, as I'll tell you, like, nothing, it's not going to get any worse. Or I hopefully won't get any worse, but, you know, you can always escalate to your HR business partner, hopefully, you know, if there is anything egregious going on. But like this notion of Kaizen and practicing, like, practice having this conversation, because you will have this conversation time and time again throughout your entire career. And the more that you do it, and the more that you can, you know, help manage up as well as you're managing down and think about, hey, can I get more context? Can I understand? Can I phrase my questions in a way that's helpful? These conversations that may perceive difficult don't actually have to be difficult, right? They are difficult because you've never done them before, but there's plenty of resources, you know, to your credit, that you can read that can help you have these difficult conversations that can have a better outcome, right? That can raise awareness, that can fill in gaps. And there's nothing, I think, better that I've learned in my career, which is what I need to do as a manager, is to create an environment where not only your team can succeed, but where you can succeed. And you know, even now I have a great relationship with my manager, and we talk all the time about, you know, strengths and weaknesses and how he can help me and how I can help him. And, you know, I tell him all the time, like, we may not, you know, disagree or agree on everything, but we understand each other and we commit to what we both feel is the best path forward. And I really appreciate that. And I think that it's a very important aspect of healthy organizations.
Yeah. Isn't it amazing, you know, when you look back retrospectively through your career? I mean, you know, I was saying that I've experienced what I thought was bad management, and it's like having conversations like this makes you realize hindsight is such an amazing thing. It's like there's so many changes that I would have made back then if only I could go back in time. It's amazing, isn't it? But, you know, I was just curious.
And that's the process of learning.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it is, absolutely, yeah. But I mean, when you're in those situations, you really don't realize that there's a way out. But looking back, you're like, there's so much you could have done at that time. It's crazy.
And I think that's the learning process that we all have to go through as we equip ourselves with the, you know, resources and options available to us.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in terms of hindsight, is maybe to one final question here, is there anything that you would have done differently in your career if you could go back in time?
That's a great question, and I have plenty of tongue-in-cheek answers. I think that working at Google in 2003 or 2004 would have, you know, been wonderful for my career. I think about, you know, I love New York. I live in Brooklyn. I've always been here. I always think about, you know, if I had moved to San Francisco, what would have that been like for my career, but also my life? I mean, in general, I'm very happy with the choices. Yes, I could have like made some different career choices that could have ended up in a better place, but I'm very content and very happy with where I am now. And I really appreciate that. And in terms of like hindsight, I'd like to reflect on the past, and I like to use that to build my own toolbox to the future and help other people. Because I think that if I had went and I visited myself, like when I was in my, you know, mid-20s, I probably would have said the same things that my managers were telling me, and I would have not listened to them because I wouldn't have believed them. And so everybody comes into like realization in their own way of certain things. And I think that we just have to respect that everybody's on their own path through this world, and you deal with the ebbs and flows and you find what fits. So, you know, the short answer to the question is like, not really, but I think that that's not the question. I think that the question is, how do you use and learn your own experiences to guide you going forward, and to just, you know, to a certain extent, be content with what you have and push yourself just enough to get what you want, you know, out of your career and out of life. And, you know, maybe that's a dramatic career switch where you do a code camp after working in some other industry for 15 years, or maybe that's, you know, leaving tech and trying to do something else, if that's what you so choose.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. We've got a very similar, you know, working life philosophy, I think. I mean, I completely kind of echo exactly what you're saying there. Well, I think that might be a nice point to wrap up, actually, Mike. And thanks so much for coming on the show. I've really, really enjoyed this. I genuinely feel like I could sit here and chat to you all day. And it actually feels like, even though we've gone into a lot of depth, it feels like we've just scraped the surface. So,
Yeah, for sure.
Thanks
well,
so
maybe
much.
Hopefully I'll be able to come back in the future. But this was great. Thank you for the time. And this was a wonderful experience.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favorite streaming platform.